Due to the themes of this podcast, listener discretion is advised. Lock your doors, close the blinds, change your passwords. This is Secrets and Spies. Secrets and Spies is a podcast that dives into the world of espionage, terrorism, geopolitics, and intrigue. This podcast is produced and hosted by Chris Carr.
On today's podcast, I'm joined by author and journalist Patrick Strickland, who wrote the book You Can Kill Each Other After I Leave, which is all about the rise and fall of the Golden Dawn in Greece. I hope you find this episode interesting. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. Take care.
The opinions expressed by guests on Secrets and Spies do not necessarily represent those of the producers and sponsors of this podcast.
Patrick, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you on.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I'm really grateful for the chance to talk.
Yeah, no, it's great to have you here. So just to begin, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you're experiencing your experiences reporting in like conflict zones has shaped your approach to reporting in Greece?
So I started reporting in 2011. And at that time, I was living in Israel and the Palestinian territory and pretty much for about four solid years. And, you know, as a reporter there, one of the biggest things you'll have to report on pretty frequently is displacement, whether or not it's during an active conflict, whether or not it has to do with land grabs, settlement expansion, home demolitions, whatever. So I had already the idea of borders and de facto borders on my mind all the time. And when I left there, I went to Lebanon for about a year, and then I joined Al Jazeera in Doha. But 2015 was when the number of refugees really skyrocketed. Nearly a million people crossed through Greece. That was the year I started coming here. I didn't live here yet at that time, but you could say that effectively I pretty much just followed the refugees when they started coming here. And that's how I ended up here.
Yeah. You've got this new book called You Can Kill Each Other After I Leave. And I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about why you wrote that book, how you went about researching it, and also what's the story behind the title? So it's three questions there almost.
Sure. Yeah, I would love to. So a lot of the reporting and research in this book goes back actually to 2015. I was gathering as much as I could because I just had this sense that this pivotal moment in history was happening, you know, with what became known as the refugee crisis. It wasn't that long after that I started having editors when I was freelancing and when I was working as a correspondent tell me that there wasn't much of an appetite for refugee stories anymore and that readers were really fatigued with refugee reporting. And that people were just kind of generally tired of that story. And I thought, well, if anyone's tired of it, surely it's the people living it.
Yeah.
And I just kind of doubled down on doing it at that time. And I followed it through. I would say that it wasn't until about 2018 that I kind of understood that I was also writing a book. And yeah, I mean, I kept reporting in this book all the way up until pretty much the end of 2024. So almost 10 years. And my sense was somewhere deep in my gut, I felt that it was really important to know this whole story. I had reported in the Middle East for years. I had reported on the reasons why people left their homes, their countries, why they got displaced. I had reported then on the dangerous journey in 2015 and after that they took to get here. But I thought that all of that was one story along with the violence that they could face and the hate speech and the conspiracy theories and the incessant incitement that refugees and migrants and other displaced people faced in Europe. This book is about Greece. It could have been about 100 other countries, you know, with the way things are going and the discourse is so similar when it comes to migration and borders. The title of the book comes from an incident in March 2018, when a little known neo-Nazi group that had some overlap, only later found out, with Golden Dawn, but wasn't in and of itself, you know, Golden Dawn or acting with its approval, firebombed the Afghan community center here in downtown Athens. And then they called a newspaper, they took credit for it, and they basically said, we want to drive all the Muslims from Greece. And a few days later, I had been, you know, in contact with the folks who worked there for a while by that point, long before it happened, because I was, you know, I mean, they worked with Afghan people who maybe don't speak Greek and they're newly arrived and they need to navigate Greek bureaucracy and the migration ministry and the asylum process. Well, all that stuff was destroyed. Asylum documents were destroyed that weren't digitized yet. You know, people's case files, files they had from their home country, which were very important to that process, all sorts of stuff, on top of their equipment, their furniture. They had a little protest a few days later outside to basically say, we're here and, you know, we deserve to live without the fear of having somebody burn down our office. And a group of men kind of gathered across the street and they started yelling, and it was just... it was just the kind of stuff you expect from people who would be offended that refugees were holding a small demonstration. We're not Muslim. We're not going to become Muslim. They should go back to their country. All sorts of stuff like that. And it got really heated for a moment. And one of the young refugees who was there turned to a police officer. There was just one police officer there. And he said, basically, can you tell those guys to leave us alone? Like, we're getting a little scared. And the police officer looked at him and said, basically, you can kill each other after I leave, for all I care, but just wait until I'm gone.
Wow. Yeah, that's a heck of a story. Can you talk to us a bit about what Golden Dawn is? Because there may be some audience members who are not overly familiar with them.
Golden Dawn was a neo-Nazi party. It didn't start out as a party. It started out as a group or an association in the 1980s. It registered as a party in 1993, I believe, right after basically a huge uptick in nationalist sentiment over Greece's dispute with its northern neighbor over the name Macedonia. Golden Dawn pretty much loitered on the fringes of the Greek political scene until Greece's economic crisis hit. So really around 2010, I believe that's the first year they got somebody in the Athens City Council. And then 2012 is the first year they made it into Parliament. And they did so with about 7% of the vote, which is not small for a party that has a swastika as its symbol and, you know, had spent years publishing in its journal, you know, kind of glorifications of Rudolf Hess and Adolf Hitler and so on.
Yeah, you would have hoped it would have been a warning for some people. But
well,
yeah, indeed. So what factors allowed Golden Dawn to rise in the aftermath of Greece's economic crisis?
Greece's economic crisis was very crushing. I've read some scholars describe it as on par, like for Greece's size, it's on par or worse than the Great Depression was in the United States.
Wow, yeah.
Unemployment skyrocketed, wages plummeted, suicide went up significantly, the rate of suicide. So there was a great sense of desperation here. And I think what a party, and it doesn't have to be, I mean, not just Golden Dawn, this is any far right party that comes along during a time of economic unease and gives you a simple explanation. It's the foreigners, it's the migrants, it's the refugees. If they weren't here, you know, we could this country would be fine, our economy would improve, so on. A left-wing explanation for Greece's economic crisis or any economic crisis as well, it's not an easy one to understand necessarily. It's certainly not as easy as the very false and racist, but very simple one that a party like Golden Dawn offers, you know? And I think that, that's part of the appeal.
Mm. And sorry, forgive me, how popular did Golden Dawn sort of become at its sort of height?
Pretty much the percentage of people voting for them kind of stayed around the same overall. But in 2015, they did become the third largest party in the parliament.
Mm, mm.
So pretty significant. And of course, they had a presence also in the European Parliament. So
yeah, pretty shocking. And you mentioned in your book about how they sort of combine street violence with parliamentary legitimacy. So can you talk to us a little bit about how they went about that and why that was effective?
In the early 1990s and the mid 90s, there's an American neo-Nazi named William Luther Pierce. The third, and he was a very influential person in the white nationalist movement in the United States. In the early 1990s, he would talk sometimes about the difference between the boots and the suits in the far right movement. Golden Dawn tried to, and for a moment, succeeded in being both the boots and the suits. The violence that they were involved in goes all the way back to the early 90s during those Macedonia protests. In the late 90s, a very brutal attack on left-wing students. And then from 2009, 2010 to 2013, really a wave of what Greek people themselves call pogroms against migrants and sometimes leftists as well in Athens and other cities around the country. But getting into the parliament gave them access to parliamentary funds. It gave them access to a platform like none other, and it made them a sort of sensation in the media as well. Not just the Greek media, but also the foreign media. For instance, Elias Kassidiadis, who was a spokesperson and a parliamentarian, is now in prison. There was a piece in Vice many years ago, a big piece about him that described him as the Nazi playboy of Greece. They were able to do that. And before the 2012 elections, there's a great documentary about it called The Cleaners, where one of the candidates for Golden Dawn said, the filmmaker asked him after the elections, what happens? And he said, after the elections, the knives come out. And of course, the knives did continue to come out after the elections.
Yeah. How effective was that sort of strategy for them? Because obviously getting parliamentary access, et cetera, is pretty serious stuff. And it kind of creates an environment of intimidation with sort of almost sort of state backing, if you know what I mean.
Right. The same guy that I just mentioned, Kassidiadis, for instance, he used his parliamentary platform to read from the elders of the protocols of the elders of Zion, the anti-Semitic hoax text. So that was a pretty significant thing. It wasn't long until other parties began to boycott them. At some point, also, their parliamentary funds were withheld. But that was because of the violence. In January 2013, two guys who it was later found out were Golden Dawn supporters followed a young Pakistani man home on his way to work, like 4 or 5 in the morning at a vegetable market, and stabbed and killed him. His name was Shahzad Lukman. He was 27, and nothing really happened. But I think that those two were arrested, but it wasn't made part of an issue of the party itself. It wasn't until 9 months later when Golden Dawn member and I believe a former staffer in their cafeteria at their offices stabbed and killed Pavlos Fissas, who was a Greek anti-fascist rapper. So after that, they weren't booted from parliament, but they were, you know, that set in motion the events that led to them being put on trial, which didn't start until 2015. But even as they were already accused of all this, all sorts of crimes, violence, weapons, hate speech, I mean, operating criminal organization, they were able to retain their spot as the third largest party in the parliament in 2015.
Yeah. What was the sort of strategy of using violence by Golden Dawn? Why were they sort of using that tactic?
Well, on the one hand, they are fanatical in their neo-Nazism. So violence is key to that. On the other hand, one of the things that they were trying to do is they were coupling the violence. I mean, it wasn't just beatings and stabbings and stuff, although that stuff happened a lot.
Yeah.
But they coupled it alongside with, let's say, holding a blood drive for ethnic Greeks only, holding a soup kitchen for ethnic Greeks only. So I think what they were, what lies at the core of that strategy is to basically try to curry favor among voters and to make those people feel like they're pitted against refugees and migrants and anybody who's, not born here or an ethnic Greek.
Yeah. Did that strategy also then, was it also designed to sort of intimidate anti-fascists as well?
No doubt. In 1992 and 3, whenever the Macedonia protests, the protests over the name happened, I mean, that's who they attacked. They attacked leftists. And one of the guys I spoke to in the book was part of a small Trotskyist group back then, and they were just handing out newspapers. And then, all come along a group of Golden Dawn guys and really just mob attack him, and he got his teeth knocked out and he got a bad cut on his leg that got infected. 1998, they almost killed students, left-wing students who they ran into by accident on the street. So a big part of it was to intimidate leftists and anti-fascists, but there was always pushback from leftists and anti-fascists as well.
Yeah. And were Golden Dawn sort of consciously drawing on any historical strategic models like the strategy of tension seen in the Cold War?
Golden Dawn drew from all sorts of sources all over. I mean, they fostered relationships with far-right groups all over Europe and North America. They even tried to have, Golden Dawn chapters in countries where there was a large Greek diaspora. So a big part of these relationships was also learning from one another. Through the 90s, like I mentioned, this guy, William Luther Pierce, neo-Nazi from the United States, Golden Dawn was doing a lot of translating of American white nationalist and neo-Nazi literature. For instance, William Luther Pierce wrote this incredibly racist novel under a pen name called The Turner Diaries.
Yeah, very famous, yeah.
Turner Diaries has been an inspiration for all sorts of fascist violence, including the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995. Mihailoliakos, who was the chief of Golden Dawn, wrote a very, somehow even worse, plagiarism and Greek version of the Turner Diaries. So really, they were imitating for a long time. But then once they were able to get their foot in parliament, they also became, a model for others. So they followed other blueprints and they also provided one. So it was an important shift, And then on top of that, they were also, Mihailoliakos had been a supporter of the 4th of August party, which was basically a pro-junta dictatorship party founded by a man named Pleveris, who was a hardcore Nazi and Holocaust denier when he was a teenager. So, these were people that also admired the military dictatorship that Greece had because it exiled and imprisoned communist and socialist en masse.
Yeah. Was there any evidence of Golden Dawn trying to infiltrate or co-opt state institutions like the police or judiciary?
There is a lot of evidence of healthy relationships between the police and Golden Dawn. There was a period when, and many people have told me, refugees and migrants who were living through it at that time, when if they got attacked by fascists, say, somewhere in downtown Athens, those people, their assailants would have already been in contact with the police. So they knew not to go file a report. If you file a report, you end up in a jail cell. If you file a report, you might end up in the deportation process. During Golden Dawn's trial and based on a lot of reporting by really great Greek reporters over the years, there was many times it was reported that people who called the police, let's say, about a noise complaint. They have Pakistani neighbors, for instance. They call the police and say, hey, these guys who live next to us are making a racket. I want to sleep, whatever. Can you talk to them? And then police officers would say, oh, they're foreigners? Call the Golden Dawn office first. They'll be much quicker than we can. So, yeah. Even in the wake of Fesis's murder, Pavlos Fesis, the rapper, after he was murdered, there were text messages that were later entered into the trial between riot police and Golden Dawn members, so they knew where the anti-fascist protests were and where they were moving. There was a lot of collusion.
Yeah, God, worrying. And you mentioned, obviously, the Golden Dawn taking influences from the US and other places. Can you talk to us about any sort of international links that Golden Dawn actually had with far-right movements?
Well, yeah. I mean, they hosted people who came here, the Nordic Resistance Movement, Casa Pound from Italy, all sorts of folks. They also visited these groups in other countries as well. That's something that's actually continued since their imprisonment. I mean, there's been neo-Nazi protests in the last couple of years where Italians and others from across Europe, Germans, have come here and joined to protest for Golden Dawn members who got killed 10 years ago, 12 years ago. So, those relationships have always been very strong. They've always had close ties with a lot of far-right movements in Orthodox countries, like Russia, like Serbia, some Greek volunteers who it's been reported that they were linked to Golden Dawn, fought alongside Serb militias in Bosnia, for instance. And there was, really close ties between Serbian nationalist leaders and not just Golden Dawn, also the Greek Orthodox Church. There was a lot of talk about the Orthodox solidarity. Now, with Russia as well, it's similar. I mean, Golden Dawn folks had visited Russia over the years many times, and they drew a lot of inspiration. Now, I wouldn't say that it was like the material support that you would see in the past with like Le Pen in France or some other far-right parties in other countries, but there was a close sense of solidarity over the Orthodox issue, but also over the welding of that to ultra-authoritarian and far-right nationalism,
Yeah, it's interesting. So what role did Russian ideologues like Alexander Dugin play in shaping and supporting their worldview?
Well, I'm sure that varies from person to person, though there is a lot of praise for Dugin in Golden Dawn newspaper publications over the years. They talk about him here and there. He's been a large influence on a lot of far-right parties, obviously, around Europe, but also even in the United States. Here in Greece, I would say that Golden Dawn took a great deal of inspiration from him and also borrowed some sort of ideological concepts as well. A lot of it was manifested in anti-Americanism, what they called anti-Zionism, which really was just anti-Semitism, intense anti-Semitism, and anti-Jewish conspiracy theories like the Great Replacement Theory and all this. So a lot of that stuff, had its roots in ideologies put forth by people like Dugin.
Mm-hmm. And has there been any material or ideological support from the Russian state itself, or was it more of a soft power alignment?
It's more of a soft power alignment, to my knowledge. As far as I know, I don't think anybody's accusing them of, having been like a Russian front party or anything like that, or like, fully propped up or something. But they were very homegrown because, for a country that had a very brutal civil war in which nationalists were pitted against communists, and then an even more brutal dictatorship under the rule of far-right colonels, military folks, there is that kernel of hardline nationalism that can give root to this sort of neo-Nazism.
Yeah, and have Golden Dawn received any sort of financial backing from American groups or anything like that?
Financial backing, it would be hard to say. You know, not that I know of. Now, there were Americans who came here a lot, not just William Luther Pierce, but also later. Andrew Anglin came here, and he wrote a lot about Golden Dawn. He was the founder of the Daily Stormer, which was a really hardcore neo-Nazi website. I heard it's going under, but I don't know yet. And he had lived here for a little while and, you know, built relationships with some of the folks in Golden Dawn. He had posted photos where he was at Golden Dawn rallies. You know, later his publication was very big and kind of giving marching orders to the people who rallied in Charlottesville in August 2017 for the big neo-Nazi and white nationalist rally that ended up deadly. And then Matthew Heimbach, who at the time led a neo-Nazi party in the United States called the Traditionalist Workers' Party, was coming to Greece quite a bit. He was so enamored with Golden Dawn, in fact, that he publicly discussed his conversion to Orthodox Christianity. So he was here many times. I wish I could put a number on it, but I can't. But there were photos of him in their office, in their parliamentary office. And then not long after that, all that stuff kind of became a big issue of criticism against Golden Dawn when Charlottesville happened. And of course, Heather Heyer was murdered in the U.S. And Matthew Heimbach appears on TV being asked, you know, are there groups that you're sort of emulating their strategy? And he says, we're primarily modeling our tactics off European, what he called European nationalists. And he said the Nordic resistance movement and Golden Dawn. So there was always this kind of relationship, a mutual support. Beyond that, not to my knowledge.
Let's take a break and be right back with more. Have you seen Golden Dawn sort of model replicated elsewhere, such as the US or UK? And what does that tell us about sort of global far-right organizing today?
I actually think that, so just a little bit of, you know, background is that their trial lasted 5 years and the party was banned in October 2020. Mm. Now, it's still under appeal, but most of, you know, several of their leading cadre, including the founder, Mihailo Liakos, are in prison now. However, it's what happened after that that I find to be the most resonant thing now. And the most resonant trend now, the most common overlap in different countries. And what it is that comparably mainstream right-wing parties have adopted a large part of the rhetoric that parties like Golden Dawn once used about borders and migration, and they've totally mainstreamed it. They dropped the swastikas and all this, but now you have the Greek prime minister has referred to migration as an invasion many times. Donald Trump calls it an invasion. I'm from Texas. I've seen the way that kind of rhetoric can move. And back in 2018, we had a mass shooting in El Paso at a Walmart where a neo-Nazi targeted Latino shoppers, you know, and killed dozens of people. And he had this manifesto that said that it was an invasion. He was trying to stop the invasion. Our governor at the time condemned it. 2 years later, our governor's using the same language. I mean, that's what's happened, in my view, is that a lot of what used to be confined to the far right just made its way into, you know, comparably mainstream right wing parties.
Yeah. Is that the term? The sort of they're changing the Overton window, where suddenly what was extreme sort of becoming normalized. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, I think about that a lot, you know, I mean, that in the, with the United States, it's gone from what used to be confined to, you know, sort of the most obscure neo-Nazi rags, to, you know, the White House, Stephen Miller, Donald Trump. And, you know, Greece's government is interesting because the party is sort of a Big Ten party, New Democracy. Outwardly, it presents itself as center-right, and it knows how to speak the language of Brussels. But, it like I said, it is a Big Ten party, and there are elements and people within this party who have, you know, overtly fascist backgrounds. And when it comes to migration, they still have those views. The migration minister now is a man named Makis Voridis, who appears a lot in this book, and was once the head of a national ultra-nationalist party called the Hellenic Front, and got a reputation in the 1980s for chasing socialist students with an axe, and later bringing Le Pen to Greece many times. So, yeah, I mean, that's the part that's really worrisome, because it seems to be taking place everywhere.
Yeah. And this, you mentioned something about the center right there. I find it really interesting because these right wing groups like Golden Dawn, etc., sort of seem to know how to speak to voters, should we say, or people who are on the center right. And then there seems to be a blind spot for those center right voters about the kind of fascist tendencies of these groups. And is there, I'm not quite sure what the question is here, but is there a way center-right people could be more vigilant about this, if that is a question? But
you know, it's not the center-right folks that I would look to provide a convincing answer myself. But one thing that is really bound to fail is the way that people left of center have tried to chase rightward. Every right-wing party, when it comes to migration, they want to speak the same language as people on the right.
Yeah, we're seeing that in the UK right now, yeah.
I've read a little bit about that. And of course, in the United States, it's the same thing. You know, they talk about, they end up sort of aping and parroting the same kind of talking points when it comes to migration, instead of taking a bold stand against it. Because whatever it is that's going to stop the fascist drift, I guarantee it won't be compromising on someone's human rights. I guarantee it won't be throwing an immigrant under the bus or a displaced person who's leaving war, you know. That's the way I see it, at least. So,
yeah. I mean, let's talk a little bit about the sort of refugee crisis. I mean, how has that amplified the right-wing narratives in Greece with your research?
2015, there was, you know, more than 900,000 people who crossed through Greece. At that time, I met people all along the way. And I was really lucky because I had already learned, I speak Arabic and I had already learned Arabic. And so that just gave me access to like a lot more people along the way. I could speak to people that a lot of reporters weren't able to, you know, because they were kind of stuck talking to who could, speak English. At that time, everybody told me that they were moving on somewhere else. Nobody was trying to stay in Greece. Mm. Germany, Sweden, Austria, you know, wherever, France sometimes. And usually what it was either that they knew somebody who was already in that country or they had relatives that were already in that country. You know, people always frame it, like, especially in the news, it's always kind of framed as solely economic, and that's definitely part of it. But a lot of it was just like, oh, I have 4 cousins in Sweden, I want to go to Sweden, you know, and who can blame you for that, you know? So when the borders were effectively shut across the Balkans in 2016, it warehoused a lot of people in Greece. And on these islands where there had been a lot of solidarity in 2015, that started to wither, because now you have these camps that are growing by the day. I mean, the Moria camp on Lesbos got like well over 20,000 people at some point, you know, in a village of like a few thousand. So, you know, it was a doomed policy to confine people to camps. And it also really fed into this right-wing anti-migrant talking points and discourse, you know, and I want to be clear that it was never just Golden Dawn. There were always many far right groups, and there are now three new ones in the parliament. But Golden Dawn at the time was, you know, the first one to go in the parliament, and they were the most organized and violent. So when people were stuck here by closed borders across Europe, that really, I think, facilitated, because Golden Dawn was long violent before that, long involvement, probably peaked before 2015, you know. But I would say that that really fueled this process of that radical right language on migration and the border moving into a comparably, you know, right-wing mainstream space.
And have you come across sort of examples of disinformation or propaganda targeting sort of humanitarian groups or migrant communities to sort of exaggerate things?
Have I come across it? Yeah, I feel like I spend my days wading through it, you know? It's like, yeah, I have a machete, yeah, and I'm just like hacking my way through it. I mean, even right now, you know, there's the last few years in Greece, there's been a constant trend of the state authorities going after humanitarians. And they're always being sort of cast as spies and, you know, Turkish spies and so on, you know, as if a bunch of, you know, young human rights activists from wherever, like on Erdogan's payroll or something. But that's the way it's often portrayed. And, you know, and one of the big pieces of disinformation too is that, you know, beyond the great replacement theory, which has become so mainstream here and everywhere else, it seems, was that, you know, this is really part of a Turkish plot against Greece. You know, Turkey turns on and turns off the tap of when there's a flow of refugees, which is, you know, I mean, it certainly has control over how much it polices its borders and people leaving. But that was a way, I think, to sort of paint in the eyes of normal folks who may have concerns over Turkey, to paint in their eyes kind of all migrants as just pawns of Turkey, and not people who, you know, have a right to search for safety and seek out asylum, you know?
Yeah, because obviously there's historical tensions between Turkey and Greece. So, I can see why sort of, there might be disinformation that's sort of trying to exaggerate that. Is that disinformation then sort of kind of created by Golden Dawn and their supporters or far-right groups, or is there, you know, because we talked a lot about in the past in this podcast about sort of Russian disinformation, it sort of looks at crisis points in a culture and then tries to exaggerate them to kind of cause tension. Have you seen any either evidence of state-backed disinformation efforts, or is it purely just sort of far-right groups doing this, or is it a bit of both?
Well, the rhetoric is always, it's always the same. I mean, you know, it overlaps in different ways, and sometimes sometimes when it enters the realm of officialdom, you know, it loses some of the more inflammatory vocabulary, but, you know, it's quite the same in my view. Golden Dawn often wrote in its newspapers about, you know, find one instance of a crime committed by, let's say, a Pakistani foreign worker, and then, you know, try to turn it into an issue of like the country being overrun by migrant criminals or something like that. Of course, that's not unique to Greece. And of course, that has been something that has been a problem for the state too, because that the government now, you know, especially since COVID, since 2020, the government has talked about migration. It wants to solely talk about smuggling gangs,
yeah,
smuggling networks, you know, and not the reasons that they exist. You know, that what really empowered these smuggling networks was the more strict and hardcore militarized border enforcement and patrols, you know, because what you did was you took away routes that people could have maybe made on their own, and you pushed them into the arms of criminal groups, you know. So it's the same in the United States. Whenever what's known as deterrence was put into practice, and that being the idea that we're going to make our presence so big on the border in certain spots where people cross that nobody will cross there. It doesn't stop them actually from crossing. It just pushes them into more dangerous and deadlier routes, like in the desert. And in the United States, it's the desert. Here, of course, it's the Aegean Sea.
Yeah.
And the last few years, you've had boats try to go from Turkey around Greece on more than one occasion, which is horrific. These are not safe vessels.
No. And I mean, yeah, we don't see it enough actually, but I mean, the human toll has been unbelievable. And am I right that there's even been penalties for humanitarian groups to try and actually help the refugees who are in trouble in the water? Is it now, illegal to help people who are in trouble in the water?
Yeah, that's a really great question. A couple years ago, I was on an island called Chios, which I reported from a lot in the book, and I was talking to a lawyer who was representing, he worked with refugees and also some humanitarians. And I said, okay, under the law, if I'm standing on the shore and there's somebody drowning 30 feet out and they just came on a boat from Turkey, can I go out there and help them? And he said that same thing. He said, that's a really good question. He said, legally, yes, but according to the application of the law, I can't guarantee that you wouldn't be then prosecuted for something or charged with something. So, and it's not just helping people too, it's the people on the boats themselves. So if a smuggler jumps ship halfway, another little speedboat comes and picks him up because he didn't want to get arrested once he comes into Greek waters, whoever grabs that steering wheel of the refugee boat is at risk of being charged as the smuggler, as the transporter. And that's happened time and again here. These people are being put on trial and a lot of times convicted.
Jeez. Yeah. So that's not really helping matters at all, is it?
So yeah. And I mean, to answer your question there, it's like, if you're on a boat and you're hoping to apply for asylum, you know, whatever, but you're not a smuggler, and the smuggler or the captain jumps off, then legally, really the only thing you can do is nothing, is wait. And maybe somebody comes, maybe not, but you can't grab that, you know, the hull, because then you could be charged as the person transporting everyone.
And is this, do you think, contributing to some of the problems now?
Definitely. You know, here's the thing, in the last 5 years, since the lockdowns started, you know, I would say that the use of pushbacks became routine. Pushbacks being illegal or extrajudicial expulsions of people. Now, that skyrocketed, and that's made it so much more dangerous for people. You know, imagine that a boat gets pushed back from Greek waters back into international waters. So, hey, we're not, you know, responsible for this, you know, like that. But sometimes those boats sink. Sometimes the Turkish Coast Guard doesn't come. The same thing's been happening on the land border with Turkey for the last 5 years as well. I've met people who have crossed 17, 18, 19 times before they were allowed to actually apply for asylum. So imagine that you cross and you get captured, you get detained, you get beat up, stripped. A lot of times they're stripped, threatened, whatever. A lot of times they're also taken, like their stuff is confiscated, their phone, their money, you know, their documents, whatever. And then that happens to you. And then they're forced to walk back across to Turkey. Now that happens to you 17, 18 times before you get to apply for asylum, which of course you have the right to do from the very beginning. Yeah. It's really grim. And because of the nature of this enforcement, it's out of sight a lot of times. We don't know for sure, you know, every detail of what happened in June 2023 when the boat from Libya sank and near Pylos in Greece and like 600 people died, you know. But I know that I spoke to a lot of people who had survived, I mean, a few, and, you know, what they said was they believe that the Greek Coast Guard was trying to tow them out of Greek waters.
Well, let's take a break and be right back with more. I was wondering if you could talk to us about the Golden Dawn trial and what it's meant for Greece and why it's mattered internationally.
Well, the trial went from 2015 to 2020, and it was initially 69 defendants. One of them died throughout the process, so it ended up being 68 defendants. That included like the entirety of Golden Dawn's parliamentary group. That included the founder, Mikhailo Liakos, and you can think of it as sort of like what we would call in the United States, like a RICO case, in the sense that what brought all these defendants together was the umbrella charge of operating a criminal organization, which, then after that, different people face different crimes, hate speech, or in the case of the man who stabbed and killed Pablo Sfisas, murder, that's how that trial panned out. And it went on for, 5 years. It was very slow moving. There was a point even when the state prosecutor wanted to drop the charges of criminal organization because I don't even want to say why. I don't know why. Of course, in the end, they were convicted. And now many of them are in prison. It was a big deal because, here's a party that at one point consciously modeled itself off, the German variety of Nazism and, wore little swastika armbands and did Hitler salutes and all sorts of stuff. And they had caused so much damage and violence, to people. And I think general sense of fear and intimidation for Greeks who either did themselves live under a military dictatorship or their parents or grandparents did, because it was only 1974 when that collapsed. That's in living memory. So I think for that, it was wildly significant in that sense. It was a big moment historically. It was important for Greek democracy in general. And it also maybe sets a bit of a precedent for other countries that may at some point, face a similar wave of neo-Nazi violence and also, support at that level.
Yeah. What lessons do you think countries like the UK and US can take from this experience with the trial of the Golden Dawn and what's happened since?
Well, actually, I think what ought to be taken from the trial of Golden Dawn is not what it did do, but what it failed to do. And that is that I think a lot of people were content, especially the government, after the guilty conviction or the criminal organization designation, to say, okay, it's not a problem anymore. We're done. Fascism's done. We got rid of it, and to take credit from that and then to boast and celebrate it, on the back of it. But, three new far right parties entered the parliament. Like I said, they don't have swastikas. One of them is called Greek Solution, which is a very telling name, I think. Another is called Niki, which means victory. And the other one's called Spartiates, the Spartans, also very telling. And, the Spartans themselves had direct ties to former Golden Dawn folks, including Cassidiades, who's the former spokesperson, who's in prison, So my point is that what I would want other countries to learn for and other societies or whatever to learn from this experience is that, yes, it is important to hold them accountable, but that legal, like a trial in and of itself, will not get rid of the problem of fascism. And I think that requires building a culture of anti-fascism from the ground up. And it can't just be a trial.
Mm-hmm. Random question. Do you think there's been a failure in education with regards to fascism maybe should we say, talk about the UK and US in particular, because there seems to be a lot of people these days who don't seem to understand what fascism is unless a fascist is wearing a Nazi uniform. And I'm just trying to work out why sort of fascism just seems to be on the rise and cutting through so easily these days, and there aren't enough people sort of taking lessons from World War II, which we talk about often in our cultures, and not connecting the dots, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do think there's a crisis of education on this. I mean, you know, I can tell you that I didn't, you know, I grew up in Texas. I didn't learn about fascism in any sense beyond maybe talking about World War II, like you said, and that would be hard events, you know, in a history or social studies class. I didn't learn anything about that, you know. I think that one of the most upsetting and disappointing parts of this current global fascist moment is that so few people can recognize that their own rights are on the line with the things that they're cheering. For instance, you know, when it comes to asylum, you know, that doesn't exist just for, you know, people from Syria or Afghanistan or whatever. That exists for everyone. Maybe one day you or me will have to walk across the border because, you know, for whatever reason, a war, you know, maybe we're being politically persecuted, whatever, you know. And if we've allowed, you know, these ultra hard right figures in governments now to basically denigrate and defang the entire concept of asylum, then we won't have that right. You know? You know, and I think that they're actually quite honest about it themselves. Trump, for instance, if you take the case of deporting people to El Salvador, you know, at first he said, we're only going to deport these terrible criminals. I mean, people who did the worst stuff. And then quickly it became also, oh, wait, we're not just going to send criminals to El Salvador. We're also going to you know, round up students who protested against the war in Gaza because their speech puts our foreign policy in danger, as if speech can put a foreign policy in danger. If your foreign policy is imperiled because of someone's speech, then you have enough problems already.
Yeah.
But then, you know, not long later, Trump said, well, also we might send some homegrowns there as well. You know, meaning U.S. citizens. Whenever the people on the far right and fascists and white nationalists tell you what they want to do to immigrants, refugees, you know, 100 years ago, 90 years ago, when they told you what they wanted to do to Jews, they're also, you know, giving you the implicit warning of what they will do to you if you don't fall in line with their vision of society. Every time.
Yeah, and not enough people seem to take that warning seriously, I've noticed.
No.
Yeah, there's a lot of excuses for it and things. Well, Patrick, we are coming close to the hour, so is there anything else you would like to add that we haven't covered that you feel is important to you?
The thing that I think is really important to point out is just that, you know, last year, migration to Greece, people crossing the Aegean, it went up significantly again. The last few years, it has been going up significantly. So people think that this what was called the European refugee crisis for so long, they think it's long over, but it's not. I mean, there are still people taking boats from Turkey and Libya and elsewhere, you know, and I just think it's really important to know that that's still going on and to know that the lack of attention means that it can get much more dangerous. Because people are dying out of sight a lot of times, and to keep that in mind, and then to look, you know, if you look at Greece during the period of 2015, and you're asking yourself, what can I do? You know, one thing to think about is to just look at the way that people here on the left tried to build a culture of anti-fascism and solidarity. You know, and it doesn't mean replicate it, doesn't mean do all the same stuff, because there was a lot of brawling on that side as well. But, you know, it does mean that in spirit, there was a large number of people here who are willing to put their body on the line in one way or another on behalf of people who ended up here, you know, by virtue of war or economic collapse or whatever.
And are there any lessons for policymakers from your research and work that you would like to impart? Is there anything that they could be doing better about handling the refugee crisis, et cetera, and the messaging around it?
Yeah, for Europe at large and here, I mean, there is so much proof over the years, so much evidence that this strategy of deterrence doesn't work. It doesn't act, like I said, since 2020, Greece has been trying to push people into more dangerous routes, effective de facto, and also militarizing its border enforcement by a lot. And the number of people for the last few years has continually gone up, the number of people who reach here. So why keep doing that? It's a lot of money, and it makes it more dangerous, and people are more likely to be injured or die or disappear. And they're being pushed into, like I mentioned, you know, smuggling networks. So why keep it up if every year you can see that the number of people coming still rises? You know, is it just to inflict pain? Because, you know, that's not good. So, you know, my thoughts are that policymakers should really consider legal pathways and safe pathways for people who may need to apply for asylum, or cross borders, you know, because they're going to cross one way or another. It's either going to be a dangerous way or the legal way.
Yeah, thank you for that. Well, Patrick, where can listeners learn about more about you and your work?
Well, listeners could pick up a copy of You Can Kill Each Other After I Leave, my book, which has been out now for a little over a month. But I also work as the managing editor of a online magazine called Inkstick Media. We cover, you know, the weapons industry, war, displacement, all sorts of stuff. We're based in the U.S., but, you know, I'm remote here in Greece, and we're a nonprofit media outlet, and you know, one of the only, if not the only, outlets that has as one of its primary focuses the defense industry and takes no money from it, because so many of these publications actually do take money from it. So inkstickmedia.com, that's where I'm at.
Thank you for your time on the show today. It's been great to have you on, and hope we can have you back in the future.
Anytime, I appreciate it.
Listening. This is Secrets and Spies.